From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the poet and philosopher Jennifer Michael Hecht, her interest in suicide was personal. When two friends and colleagues killed themselves a few years ago, she says it forced her to confront how we think about our lives and our deaths today. She found that as a society, we haven't really come to a consensus about suicide. I mean, there is the religious belief that God forbids it, but Hecht says that's our culture's only systematic argument. In her new book, she makes a philosophical one, one that everyone pretty much can agree with, that those who are thinking of ending it all owe it to society, to the community, and to their future selves to stay. That's the name of the book, and we'll talk about it after this news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2009, after a friend and colleague had killed herself, the second friend in 2 years who had committed suicide, the writer and poet Jennifer Michael Hecht wrote an open letter in a poetry blog. In it, she laid down a rule, an injunction. "You are not allowed to kill yourself," she wrote. The letter is remarkable for its bold treatment of the subject of suicide. She wasn't just making a plea, but a case that suicide is wrong. Not a religious case, a philosophical one. Suicide, Hecht says, harms the community. It damages humanity. And she says it unfairly preempts a person's future self. The letter has eventually become a book in which she explores the history, the research, the philosophical arguments for why a person contemplating suicide should stay. That's the name of the book. And today in the program, we're talking about it. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jennifer Michael Hecht has written a number of books on philosophy and history. They include the book Doubt and the Happiness Myth. And as I mentioned, she's also a poet, of course. Her collections include Who Said and Funny. She's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Jennifer Michael Hecht, welcome. Thank you very much for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I wanted to sort of start with that that letter you wrote, that essay. Mm-hmm. And I want to get you to read a section from it. This is, as I mentioned, this was the second of two friends and colleagues of yours in 2009 who had committed suicide. And
And they knew each other, too.
Yeah, you were all friends, I guess. And so what was it that you wanted to say in the letter? What was it that you were trying to get at first?
Well, I really had spent a lot of time thinking about it after the first time it happened. So when it happened again, I had all these sort of had a rather worked out idea about how I felt, which is because of the book Doubt that I wrote, which is a history of religious doubt all over the world throughout time, I had really done a lot of thinking about how secularists could deal with an incredible emotional pain. You know, if you believe even a little, you know, you could fall on your knees and pray. But what about those of us who, you know, we don't work that way? Yeah. And I started to really think about what community meant, what we meant to each other, and that you could sort of lean on the community even in a conceptual way, you know, without even making a phone call, of just knowing that they matter to you, so you matter to them. The first suicide had hurt me so much that it made me realize that just staying around was doing doing the community this kind of favor, even if you weren't doing much. Just persisting, we do each other this great favor, and that's true for people who know each other, but even wider in the community. A suicide in a community very often leads to more, often within that same age and gender.
I want to have you read this section, if you would, because it's really lovely and it's powerful. And as I mentioned in the introduction, I think, and which we'll talk about, it's pretty candid. Read the section, if you would.
I certainly will. This is the these are the last two paragraphs after I've sort of made the argument. Then I say, the truth is that I want you to live for your sake, not for ours. But the injunction is true and real. Anyway, some part of you doesn't want to end it all. And I'm talking to her or him, to that part of you. I'm throwing you a rope. You don't have to explain it to the monster in you. Just tell the monster it can do whatever it wants, but not that. Later, we'll get rid of the monster. For now, just hang on to the rope. I know that this means a struggle from one second to the next, let alone one day at a time. Know that the rest of us know that among the faces we have met, there are some right now who can barely take another minute of the pain and uncertainty. And we're in the room with you, going from one moment to the next, in whatever condition you manage to do it. Sobbing and useless is great. Sobbing and useless is a million times better than dead. A billion times. Thank you for choosing sobbing and useless over dead. There are poets and other artists, psychotherapists and average Joes who are thinking of your struggle and appreciating what you have managed to put up with. We are grateful. Best of all, practicing tuning in to your gratitude for others staying alive also tones up your ability to feel the gratitude that people are extending to you, too, to start to feel the support of it, the invisible arms. Don't kill yourself. Suffer here with us instead. We need you with us. We have not forgotten you. You are our hero. Stay.
I guess one of the first questions we should sort of get out of the way, I suppose, is whether suicide is growing. And you point out in the book that it is, and it seems pretty dramatic.
It's growing exponentially. It's really out of control right now. Researchers were surprised to find it hit 30,000 about 10 years ago, and last year it was almost 40,000. It's growing in all sorts of different sectors of society.
Among America's top 10 causes of death? This was interesting, too. You write that for those under 45, it's in the top three.
That's right. Yeah, it just it just overtook everything. But if you count alcohol and alcohol related vehicle accidents together, then they beat out suicide. But otherwise, suicide is among the top the top killers of college students, which is astounding. Suicide took more active soldiers last year than combat.
And I wanted to get this out of the way, too, because you mentioned in the book that the book is not really about suicide for those who are, you know, suffering from terminal conditions or diseases.
Right. I don't even really consider that suicide. It's that seems to me managing a fatal illness.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also make it clear, these are the disclaimers, Jennifer Michael Hecht, that you're not pronouncing a judgment on those who have, of course, committed suicide.
Right. Which is, you know, I can say that, but there's also a way in which I am saying that there's a moral rationale here for this. That mostly I'm trying, yes, to save people's lives. Yes, to make us feel better in general. Because I think many people who never kill themselves vacillate thinking about it.
Yeah.
And it's very painful. And I've been told by some of them that having a good reason not to do it makes that a lot less painful. Just like if you're feeling suicidal, walking across a bridge would be very scary. If there was a barrier up, you could feel okay. And this is a sort of conceptual barrier.
What's remarkable about the essay and the way you're sort of the letter that you wrote, I think, is that you do take this point of view, because in the book you write about how generally we ask people not to commit suicide, mm-hmm. but you say we don't say you must not do it.
That's right. And in most societies at most times, there have been more vigorous attempts to tell people that we really want them to stay, that we need them. And I'm trying to enliven that idea in Western culture. We've really had the church took over in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. took over this argument to such a degree with just God says no, it's the worst sin, you'll go to hell, which meant that secularists and rationalists in the period leading up to the Enlightenment and the Enlightenment itself and afterwards would tend to say, oh, no, it's my body. I can do as I want. We've taken it as an important liberty, as an important right. And I think we need to rethink that a little bit because, you know, there have been many great sort of secular thinkers who thought that what we owe ourselves and what we owe each other is an important reason to say no. You know, Nietzsche played around with the idea that without a God, even homicide was okay. Well, it's not. Diderot in the Enlightenment and Bertrand Russell in the beginning of the last century thought that maybe marriage would be over when religion declined. But we decided that we like it. You know, we've changed a lot of the rules, but we haven't thrown it out. And sometimes secularists are wrong to just take their opinion as the opposite of what religion's saying. Sometimes religion has the right principle, but with the wrong rationale.
I guess it reflects the way we maybe don't talk much about suicide or don't have these conversations in that when I hear you write or see you write suicide is wrong and call it self-murder even at one point in the book, I kind of wince. But I guess you really want to be very clear about that.
Right. You know, self-murder is Hamlet's phrase. Yeah. So I've seen it in other places as well, you know, citing Hamlet. But yes, I do think that, for instance, you know, there are ways in which we are each these integrated identities, this single self. But in another way, our minds change all the time. We fall in and out of love. We like a movie, and then later on we see it and we don't like it. We change all sorts of aspects of ourselves according to our mood, our how hungry or sleepy we are, according to a million things. And I don't think it's right to allow one of your moods to murder all the others. I do see the notion of, you know, speaking to some past self of yours and saying, is this how you want this to end? Or imagining a future self. There have been so many suicide attempts, serious ones, where the person is saved and goes on to live a long life and express great gratitude that they didn't die. So the idea of saying it's wrong, it seems to me there are a couple of different rationales by which it really is wrong. But it's also wrong because if you're the kind of person who would desperately want to help others, it's worth thinking about the pressure that you put on people, the burden that you become if you kill yourself. Most people who contemplate suicide are doing it partially because they're seeing themselves as a burden. They don't feel useful because they either have just had a major disappointment or are depressed. And they feel like they're a burden on other people. And they think it's the right thing to do. Yeah. So they should hear at least once that, in fact, they're much likely to be a much, much greater burden if they kill themselves to people who love them and people who know them and to the wider community.
You know, the idea that God forbids suicide, it's that argument that, as you put it in the book, gets all the press these days. But you say outside of that, we don't really have a coherent argument against it. We don't have a logical consensus as a society beyond the, you know, religious prescriptions. Have we ever as a society in our history?
Yeah, we really have. And I didn't really know this until I started doing the research for the book. I had a sense of it. But Aristotle's very clear that he says you can't burgle your own house, but you are doing a crime when you kill yourself because you don't only belong to yourself. You belong to the community. We believe each other into being, in a certain sense. Plato said it was wrong that we must stand as a guard at our post and see what happens. In the more modern world, Victor Hugo said we must struggle against it. Hugo even used the same sort of terminology that I did do. And I was shocked to see it, but he says that when. You know, if anyone in the world cares about you, your suicide also becomes a kind of murder because other people will die from it. He's not quoting statistics the way I am, but he's certainly seeing the kind of misery that it leads to. And I can go on naming people who really philosophers, writers, artists who came out very strongly against suicide, including Camus, who people yeah. often think of as allowing suicide because he was so interested in talking about it. But his own conclusion was no, yeah. you mustn't.
Yeah, well, I want to come back to that, actually, and I do want to break down some of the particulars of some of these thinkers. Did it surprise you that there was such a, you know, thread of people objecting to it? I mean, did that surprise you that there was so much talk, you know, among philosophers
yeah,
and others?
Yeah, and such interesting stories, you know, yeah. The ways that these things happen throughout history and the ways that they keep referring to each other. You know, Rome was founded. I remembered this from, you know, my studies as a historian, that Rome was founded because of a suicide in the ancient world. Lucretia yeah. Was... a highborn woman who was living at a time where the Etruscan kings were ruling the Roman land. The Roman people already existed, but they were tolerating Etruscan rule. And a Etruscan prince raped her. And he told her that if she told anyone, he would kill her and the slave, put them in a male slave, put them in bed together and say that he chanced upon them and killed them, you know, in order to protect her, the husband's honor. Yeah. So she had to choose between allowing this to happen to her or losing her honor. And so she goes to her father and her husband and calls together the men of her clan and tells them what happened and then takes out a dagger and stabs herself in a sort of defense of the family's honor and then hands them the dagger and says, you know, swear by this that you will get rid of these Etruscan kings and indeed all kings. And that's so that this kind of abuse can't happen. And that's the reason for the founding of the Roman Republic. So it's an extraordinary vision of what life means. And, you know, it was repeated in stories throughout history. One of Shakespeare's only two long poems was about Lucretia, all about her. She runs right through Western civilization. And at first she's seen just as this model of integrity. But by the time you get to Shakespeare, for sure, people are saying, no, she was wrong to do it. She should not have done it. It wasn't her sin.
You write about later in the book about Rembrandt's painting of Lucretia.
Yeah, Rembrandt paints her too. Yeah.
Which is, I found it one of the most compelling parts of the book in the sense that because it's that moment, as you point out, where she's in despair. Clearly, she's
yeah.
deeply troubled. But and this is the sort of the clincher for you anyway. She's still alive.
Yeah, yeah. You see, in the Renaissance, the very early depictions of her show her already dead and very small, and the soldiers are much larger, and the looming Roman architecture is larger than that. The state is very large, and her action seems to be a small sort of pearl at the center of this whole thing. And then you start to get these paintings, and she was painted by just an incredible array of great painters. You start to see where she is the forefront. And it's not about her death, but about her moment of contemplating death. She's almost always holding a dagger. She's in a state, different states of undress. She looks beautiful in some and sort of ugly with fear in others. And they're very dramatic. And they're very much close-ups on this woman's face. And they really are looking at her and sort of keeping her alive, but noting the pain, being willing to see this. And that's one of the things I think our culture needs right now, because we're so upset by it that we don't talk about it. And that means that everybody feels very isolated.
Jennifer Michael Hecht is with us. She's the author of the book Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the poet and philosopher, writer Jennifer Michael Hecht, who's been studying suicide, drawn to the issue for very personal reasons. She's joining us to explain what she's learned in her book. It's called Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So you were talking about, again, the sort of the ancient history of suicide. You mentioned Lucretia, of course. And but the question, you also talk about whether or not suicide was common. I mean, you say that the ancient Jewish world and the Greek world, even the Roman worlds, they weren't necessarily against it, but it doesn't seem that it was all that common.
Right. They had some heroes who were suicides and who weren't really denigrated for that. So Samson in the yeah. Hebrew Bible, but suicide comes up very infrequently in these texts. And we do also have these philosophers and writers who write specifically against it. So it's been misunderstood. The whole medieval period thought, the whole Christian world very much thought of the ancient world as being very tolerant mm-hmm. about it. But we look back and we see, you know, these societies were so well integrated that people didn't quite have the same kind of alienation that we do.
Pythagoras seems to be one of the first philosophers to really kind of speak out against it.
Yeah, very early.
And Plato, mm-hmm. of course, the two, as you mentioned. What about Socrates in his dying scene? He gives in to suicide himself, doesn't, you know, he could have gotten out of it.
Well, I don't think we would call it a suicide, really. He's a famous suicide.
Yeah.
He's probably the most famous suicide. But since he was compelled to do it by a court, we're looking at someone who's only understood as a suicide because he's the one holding the hemlock
yeah.
and because we know he could have escaped, but he decided that the right thing to do would be to follow the letter of the law. He tells his friends and students who are in that final room with him that they mustn't follow his lead, that they must not kill themselves unless they're compelled to in the same extreme way that he is.
It's interesting how Christianity comes to see eventually suicide, of course, as a sin. But as you point out, it evolves and takes shape in the Roman Empire. For the earlier Christians, it wasn't considered a sin. You mentioned it in some ways; it was celebrated.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and I think that's why the religion comes out so strongly against it. Because for the first really 300 years of Christianity, Christians are persecuted, and because of that, martyrdom was the rage. There are even some scholars who look at that as a kind of a kind of suicide cluster after the first traumatic sort of suicide of Jesus. You know, there are many places in the New Testament, the Christian Bible, where Jesus or one of his followers refers to his death as being in his control. In John, he says, "No man kills me; I lay down my own life."
Right.
But there was so much martyrdom, and some of the martyrs didn't wait to be killed by some persecution. They you know, ceremoniously took their own lives for Christianity, which sort of worked for Christianity while it was still illegal. But once Constantine makes it legal in 310. After that, it starts to be, you know, we're really just losing membership, and the church starts to come out against it and say, if you're a martyr who really was a suicide, we're taking you off the lists of martyrs, and then saying, if you take your own life, even if you think you're doing it out of martyrdom, you're not going to be able to be buried in sacred ground,
yeah.
And then soon after they start actually torturing suicides' corpses, which is very strange. But they, you know, it was a deterrent. You know, when you saw these things happening, and they would confiscate the estate, so your family couldn't inherit your estate. These things certainly dissuaded some suicides.
Yeah.
They're barbarian. I certainly wouldn't want anything like that. But I'm just trying to point out that there have been different ways that cultures find to try to keep people alive in their dark times. And if people feel bad enough, and if they've thought about it enough, and if they have the means, you know, they may do it anyway. Mm-hmm. They certainly did through the Christian era. We have lots of evidence of it. But this was an extreme response to a couple hundred years of people embracing suicide within Christianity.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Susan sends this email from Salt Lake City. She writes that in 1959, my great-grandfather committed suicide, and the county newspaper reported in detail how he did it and how my great-grandmother found him. Our obituaries today, she writes, don't mention suicide, and I see this as a double-edged sword. I understand that one suicide can lead to other suicides. It's a point Jennifer Michael Hecht we're going to get to, by the way. So there may be some value in not underscoring it, Susan writes, but it also means we're not having frank conversations, say, about social issues like gay youth who are turning to suicide. She says, you're opening up the conversation with your book. How should we open our conversations about suicide? How open should they be?
Yeah, that's an excellent question and really astute. It's very much true that we started to notice, especially in the 60s and 70s, researchers started to notice that that suicides in the public media led to more suicides. So the federal government put out some guidelines for how we report suicide. To not mention the means at all, and to only mention that it was a suicide in the body of the text, not in the headline, and to not show pictures of the suicide body, to concentrate on certain aspects of the story, because you know we have evidence that it leads to less death. But it's also true that when there's one suicide in, say, a school, there's very likely to be more suicides unless people come and do what's called talk-throughs, right. You know, which really people have very different ways of doing that. But to just address it and talk, you know, have people have a way of dealing with their feelings definitely helps. Indeed, it can make it so that there's no cluster effect. So we do have to find a way between these two extremes. We certainly do. But even in historical times, before we had statistics for it, coroners used to refuse to give the gun or the cup that the poison was in back to the family because there was such a history of people reusing those items for the same.
Yeah. One of the arguments you make in the book is that sometimes what we call suicidal influence is so strong, suicide could in some ways be considered a homicide.
Yeah, I mean, I say it because I think that it puts a fine point on it. Of course, it's there are limits to how we'll see it. As I've said, Victor Hugo said the same thing, and I do think that the most important aspect of that is the flip side of it, that we realize that we're saving lives when we save our own lives. And in general. In this culture, at this moment, we overstate mental illness in terms of suicide as if a suicide, any suicide, was somewhat inevitable, that it was an end point of mental illness and that it can only be dealt with by experts in mental illness. But it's simply not the case for a couple of different reasons. One is so many people don't have any. They don't get help. And they're living in a culture that influences people very much. And so this thing is also about ideas. It's also about social pressures and social examples. We know we've never had as much psychopharmacology as we've had in the last 10 years, and yet the suicide rate has gone up exponentially in this period. So clearly we have to look at this from a couple of different viewpoints.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Let's go to the phones. William is with us in Salt Lake City. William, welcome.
Thank you. So I have two friends that had committed suicide, one in high school and one as an older adult friendship. I've also been in law enforcement and had to respond and investigate suicides. Those instances and incidents that I've been involved in, the people that take their lives generally have been struggling with mental illness for quite some time. So my question is to you, Jennifer, is what is the difference in those cases than someone who is terminally ill and is managing that illness with their own suicide, for instance, in Oregon, yeah. Where they do have that? If you could maybe explain that further,
sure.
I'd appreciate it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. For one thing, there certainly are a lot of examples of people who, well, say with the soldiers, some 52% of the mostly very young, mostly men who took their lives in the period of years of this study were seen to have within the last 3 months broken up an important relationship or had some major sort of frustration, major painful event in their lives. So it really can be a person who's – sure, they're not happy-go-lucky, but in many cases, it's people who are not clinically depressed in a way that they're just stuck in bed and they're always miserable. You know, I didn't put this in the book, but I do have in my mind that, you know, if we were to come further in this conversation in terms of legality, I wonder if we couldn't make some sort of a roadmap or a rule of thumb that, you know, if you had the agreement of several doctors and several family members and several friends who all said, yes, it's time for you to take your leave. Well, that would be a big reason to say, OK, maybe in your case. But think about all the teenagers who kill themselves. They don't have the wherewithal to know if the pain that they're suffering at that moment in their lives is really going to rule them forever. And we also just have so much data. We followed around hundreds of people after suicide attempts and found that 94% of them were still alive 25 years later, either still alive or died from natural causes. And it really suggests that while there is some sort of threshold where somebody who's profoundly mentally ill and has gone through this over and over and over could be looked at in the same idea as someone terminally ill. And I do think in some of those cases it has to be adjudicated on its own terms. Mm-hmm. Well, there's also places in our culture where we say homicide is reasonable in war and in punishing criminals and yet we know that homicide is basically wrong. And I guess I'm trying to open up the conversation and put this on the bookshelf that everybody else has, where many progressive thinkers think about the idea of suicide as a natural right, as each an individual. It's almost a way of expressing your individuality. Well, we're not entirely individuals. We recycle when the people around us recycle. We smoke when the other people around us smoke. We overeat when they do. We have three children instead of two or four. There are profound ways in which we're deeply integrated into each other's lives. And when you see the suicide rate jump like that, when there's no good reason to think that mental illness has jumped like that, especially if we believe that it's the biological aspect of it, we have to see that, yeah, there might be some people whose cases have to be adjudicated in a separate way outside of this. But I think there's just an incredible number. I mean, more people commit suicide in this country every year than are murdered. More people commit suicide in this country than died in the AIDS epidemic, except for the three worst years of it. A million people a year in worldwide. And worldwide, more people kill themselves these days than are murdered. So it really does bear some degree of, if you knew you could save lives, cure some people's cancer by talking, by thinking and discussing and looking at some old ideas, it makes sense to step out and do that. And suicide is killing more people than cancer in most age groups until you get quite elderly. I do very much appreciate the question and the sentiment. I don't want anyone to suffer more than is bearable, but I do want people to know that lots of us are suffering. Life is hard. Yeah. There's a lot of suffering. But let's try to stay and suffer with each other and see what we can do to take care of each other. That's the direction I feel like I need to go in.
William, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jennifer Michael Hecht is with us. Her book is Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Jennifer Michael Hecht. We're talking about her latest book called Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So you mentioned before that religion sort of took this wrong turn by relying too much on the idea of, you know, God's disapproval of suicide. But you also say, you know, secular philosophy took a wrong turn by figuring that, you know, without a God, man is, you know, he's his own master. And so people should be free to kill themselves. When does that table start to turn? I guess this was during the Enlightenment?
Yeah, you see it before the Enlightenment in some of the sort of philosophical clubs that where you see all sorts of rejecting of religious ideas, many of which we've changed our mind about and seen as good parts of society. But certainly in the Enlightenment, David Hume and the Baron d'Holbach in France, Hume in England, they both wrote in favor of suicide, but they were writing very much against the church. They weren't really considering what a life might lead mean and how others would feel. They were sort of joking that you know if God is the one preventing us from suicide, then if a rock was falling on our heads and we step aside, is that a sin? They really were much more poking fun at the church, but they were, you know, setting forth this argument that that can lead to a great deal of despair and darkness. I really believe that though it's hard to feel all the time, that life has meaning. There have been many secularists who have suggested that we have to make our own meaning. Bertrand Russell is one, because there's no God. I believe that the meaning exists outside of us, that it's communal and historical and cultural, and that we don't have to make our own. We have to open ourselves up to feeling the meaning that's there. And no, we're not going to feel it all the time, but love is very strange too, but it's real. And we can't feel it all the time. And sometimes we have a lot of trouble with it, but we still fight for it and believe in it. And I believe in human meaning in that sense as well.
So I guess we're trying to find a kind of equilibrium. I mean, so this value of the self that comes from the Enlightenment comes at the expense of the value of tradition, the value of community. The idea is to try to sort of right ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That we overstate the individuality. And the Enlightenment gives us this wonderful idea of individuals mattering so much, but it also invites us to judge our own lives and take leave. But I have to say, a lot of very dark, gloomy thinkers come out on my side on this thing. Schopenhauer is like the most famous and brilliant pessimist. And yet he came to the conclusion that suicide was wrong. And you know, a good 100 years after it, Wittgenstein, the wonderful Viennese philosopher who was depressed his whole life and went in and out of suicidal feelings. 3 out of 4 of his brothers committed suicide.
Wow.
And one of his cousins.
Yeah.
But Wittgenstein didn't. And he cites Schopenhauer's argument, but he also makes up one of his own, which is he says if suicide is allowed, everything is allowed. If suicide is not allowed, then some things are not allowed. That is, he sees the basis of morality not as harming other people, but that this basic idea of believing in ourselves in the world, that's the basis of morality, and that we believe each other into being in a certain way. Kant says it's wrong to kill yourself because you take the morality that is you out of the universe, the goodness that is in you out of the universe. Great medieval philosopher Maimonides said, "He who destroys himself destroys the world." And Camus, as we said, who's wrote a book wherein the first line is suicide is the first philosophical question. Nothing else matters until you decide why you would stay alive. And, you know, he shocked everyone by asking that. And he's very much remembered as this dark, suicidal kind of figure. But he decides, no, life is absurd but worth living.
Yeah. Well, I think what seems like the innovative thought, or one of them anyway, from Camus on this point was – as you write about, the quality of life doesn't really matter. The value is the point of, as you put it in the book, paying attention and sticking around.
Yeah, Camus is an incredible outlier in that sense. Almost all philosophers take pains to tell people it doesn't really matter when you die. Look, life, there's going to be a huge abyss of not living on either side of your life anyway. And people come and they go, and you should sort of tune into that side of things and try to live well and make something of your life while you're alive. But don't worry too much about when you die. Mm-hmm. And Camus takes the opposite position and says, life is hell, and his best metaphor for it is Sisyphusian, you know, that it's pushing a boulder up a hill and then just watching it roll back down and doing it again. But Camus says we must imagine Sisyphus happy, that what we do in staying alive is rebel against death, even though we know it's coming at the end, but we refuse to get used to it. And he says that life doesn't have to – he says it really doesn't even matter what kind of life you have. You don't have to make the best of it. You have to pay attention that everybody's 60 or 80 years is pretty similar if you're paying attention, and that it really matters to stay the extra 20 years.
What does the to be or not to be speech in Hamlet tell us about how Shakespeare was thinking of suicide?
Yeah. There's an earlier place in Hamlet where Hamlet says, if only the Almighty had not put such a strong ban against it. And so in that sense, he dismisses it in religious terms. You know, there you have an example of it working. Here's this very sad guy who's doesn't seem clinically depressed, folks. He's not in bed, but something, you know, he's suffered a terrible reversal. You know, his uncle and his mother have killed his father, and his father has asked him to avenge them. It's a terrible position. So when he gets to the to be or not to be, he's feeling very suicidal. He decides against it very much because he isn't sure if there's an afterlife, and if there's an afterlife, is it worse?
Yeah.
He doesn't put it in particularly religious or Christian terms. He just says, well, you know, what about the bad dreams that may come? What if it's worse? And he even says, who wouldn't kill themselves if we weren't scared of death? Because life is so horrible, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Mm. We suffer. But, you know, why has humanity loved that speech? First of all, it's, you know, just an incredible piece of poetry. But It's an admission that life is extremely hard, that it's painful, and that we get through it. Sometimes we can't look at it in terms of, you know, where's my happiness? You know what? Life isn't always happy. And if we acknowledge that to each other, we all do better.
One of the questions you get to in the book is, you know, is one of the predictors of suicide knowing someone else who committed suicide? There's an email from Sina who writes, I had a friend whose grandfather had killed himself at the age of 45. His father also killed himself at 45. Is there a link?
Yeah, there's so many studies that show that if a parent kills themselves while the kids are under 18, those kids are three times as likely to kill themselves. Sure, there's some mental illness inheritance things, but your family being depressed doesn't make you more likely to kill yourself. It's the example. And we have that from so many individual poets and writers who've talked about being obsessed with a specific – Spalding Gray, who killed himself not that long ago, wonderful writer. And his mother had killed herself, and he wrote of that she it felt to him that he would kill himself when he reached the age when she did, because he felt her sort of calling to him in this very direct way. We see that with the poet John Berryman as well, and the Hemingway family. But there are lots of good epidemiological, sociological, and psychological statistical studies that show how these clusters seem to work. And I ended up devoting a whole chapter. I thought it was fascinating material of just showing the numbers and showing how this thing seems to work.
801-585.
How we get influenced.
Yeah. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Let's go back to the phones. Brad is with us in Salt Lake City. Brad, welcome.
you for taking my call. I'm going to apologize for diverting the conversation away from philosophy and into more pragmatic questions. I have a couple of friends and family members who have at one point or another contemplated suicide. And around this time last year, I remember several of them telling me what they felt was getting lost in the debate after Sandy Hook and the aftermath about guns and about gun regulation, which was that they were extremely grateful that at their darkest moments there hadn't been a gun easily available to them. Yep. So I'm wondering, A, what your guest knows about any kind of statistical correlation between firearm availability and suicide incidents, and whether or not, I mean, things like mass shootings happen very, very rarely, and it's kind of strange to have the conversation about gun regulation revolve around those when so many more people take their own lives with guns every year than are killed by mass shootings.
Yeah. Jennifer Michael Hecht, what do you think?
Well, I can tell you two statistics. A little over one half of the gun deaths in the United States are suicides, and also about one half of the suicides in the United States are with a gun. It's an incredibly important aspect to this. Look, in the UK, in the 90s, they banned selling acetaminophen, Tylenol, in packages that were more – they banned selling it in large bottles. They made it small packages and in those bubble packets. And the suicide rate went down. You need about 50 of these pills. Nobody wanted to sit there and take out 50 pills. If we put up a barrier on a bridge, people don't just go to another bridge. There's the idea of something specific in your mind. So the ovens that Sylvia Plath killed herself by putting her head in the oven in England, they changed the way the ovens worked. And the suicide rate, again, went down because that was like having a gun in the house. It was just too easy. But suicide is very impulsive. Again, people feel like it's inevitable these days because of the conversation we have and the way we talk about it in terms of mental illness. But it very often passes. And if you have a gun, a loaded gun, when you're feeling that way, or bottle pills and some alcohol, you're in much, much more danger than otherwise. And yeah, I think it's astounding when people realize that half of the gun deaths in the United States are suicides. Mm.
Brad, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, again, the number two. Join the conversation. In the essay that you read earlier, you write about this monster in you that, you know, needs to be outsmarted until it can be chased away. So I'm wondering what you sort of learned about that, this question of whether anyone who kills themselves are in their right mind. I mean, we got an email from another Brad who writes, "I don't believe suicide is a good or right choice in any case. Calling it wrong, he says, seems to blame the person, even though they are perhaps suffering from something completely beyond their control." What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, you know, it's just that many of us are in some control. I think that the very idea, you know, Schopenhauer sort of suggested that there was like an imp in us that wanted to do this, and Wittgenstein repeated it, a century later. And it seems to me that they were able to use this idea to get out ahead of that. Of that impulse, and to say, you know, when I have that feeling, I'm just gonna say no to it. I know that sounds easy, but I I'm taking it lightly, but I feel that it's a potent way of coping, and it's one that, you know, I've had some dark times, and that's why I came up with all of this and went looking for it, and it works for me, and I've heard from other people that it works. Obviously, you're not going to save everybody, but people ought to know that these arguments exist, and that we're all in this together, and there are ways of thinking about it that can be just the amount of strength you need to get through it. Just like not having a gun in the house, but having a good argument is sometimes it's enough to give a person a reason. I've talked to so many people and read so many books about people just vacillating, thinking, you know, what should I, why should I be here? And you can take that off the table and say, you're here. Let's try to deal with it. Let's see what we can do instead of thinking about that other thing about walking out. So I entirely appreciate that there's always going to be a certain amount of pushback on this. But I decided not to put that in the book at all because I felt like I don't want somebody saying, well, if super sad people are allowed to go, then I should do it just to show how sad I am. I'm as sad as anybody. And I want to say, you know, there have been a lot of people who have been very sad and even very suicidal who've been able to put up a barrier against that, either quoting the idea that the devil is the one trying to make them kill themselves, mm-hmm. and they fight against it to be on God's side, or because they know Aristotle said it was wrong, and so they fight against it, or you know, hopefully for some modern reasons that we can see our value and our worth if we use history and philosophy a little bit more potently.
You write at the end of the book, a person choosing to die or to live exists in, you put it this way, in the very crucible of human morality and meaning. And you say, yeah, it's kind of frightening to think about that, but this is the, these are the important insights about what it means to be human, that I guess living in that crucible. It's scary, but that's the point.
Well, and the great philosophers, it's amazing how many of them mention that pain gave their life depth, that, you know, while you're in it, it's horrible, but that you gain wisdom and maturity and creative ability and that we don't, you know, nowadays we think of pain as something to just get rid of. And of course, if I could get rid of your pain, I'd do that. But these medications only work so much and only for so long. And there are all sorts of ways that we can try to address the pain, but it's also worth remembering that there's some things that can be learned from that kind of pain. It gives us compassion for others. It gives us humility. In some ways, it's a terrible blessing.
Jennifer Michael Hecht. Her book is called Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. Joined us from New York City. Dr. Hecht, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. It's wonderful.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.